Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, Friday, June 6th, we've got quite a stack of sources pulled together, articles, reports, some official statements.
Yeah, a real mix.
Yeah.
And they give us these snapshots of what's really moving and shaking in Zambia right now.
Our mission, as always, is pretty simple. Cut through all the noise, find the most important bits, the key insights.
And basically give you that shortcut so you're quickly informed on what's shaping the conversation.
Exactly. So today's deep dive is specifically into the news hitting Zambia this week. And it's, well, it's diverse. We're talking shifts in national governance, the legal scene.
Then diving into some pretty big economic developments. And there's a fascinating piece on building our future workforce too.
Right. And we'll even touch on sports at the end. It seems like a lot, but you know, each piece tells a part of that bigger story about the country's direction.
Definitely. So let's jump right in and see what these sources are really telling us.
Okay, first up, we have some significant national news. And it's a moment that really calls for reflection across the country.
Yes. Our sources are reporting the passing of Zambia's sixth Republican president, Mr. Edgar Chagwa Lungu.
News diggers had an interesting perspective. They noted his death is felt as a loss, obviously to his family and his party, but they framed it as a loss for the entire nation.
They described his time in office, as running his race with quiet tenacity, served during what they called a critical period for Zambia.
And they positioned his contributions as a part of the country's ongoing, evolving democratic journey.
It's also interesting how they captured the different ways people saw him. You know, many things to many people.
Right. To his supporters, he was seen as, well, humble, calm, steady.
But then those closer to him apparently highlighted his warmth, kindness, even a sense of humor. Kind of paints that picture of the public figure versus the private person.
And the ruling party, the UPND, they also sent out a message. They remembered him as a dedicated former member who rose to the highest office.
And importantly, they acknowledged his contribution to consolidating Zambia's democracy. They called it a rare achievement and honorable feat.
They were quite clear, though, that while political disagreements happen, you know, that's democracy. Death is something else. A painful, shared human experience.
Yeah, their message really called for unity and diversity during this period of mourning, appealing for the nation to mourn with dignity, respect for him as a person, and for the office he held.
It feels like a notable call for, well, national unity at what is obviously a difficult time.
So moving on from that moment of national reflection, the sources also bring us news of some pretty significant developments within the legal and governance structures.
That's right. We've got news from the judiciary. High Court Judge Amelia Sankutu resigned. That was this past Wednesday, June 4th.
And this came just a week after she'd been suspended by President Hichilema.
The sources mention her previous roles, too. She was judge in charge in Mansa, and before that, in Ndola.
And there was a comment from Lusaka lawyer Yona Zimba. He basically said she was within her right to resign.
Yeah, and he added that her decision effectively shortens the process of her removal from office. So it seems her resignation formally concludes things following that suspension.
Okay, alongside that, we're seeing some action from a key accountability body, the Anti-Corruption Commission, the ACC. They've been active.
Yes, the ACC arrested five officers from RTSA, the Road Transport and Safety Agency. That was on June 5th. The charge: alleged corrupt practices.
The ACC Director General laid out some, well, pretty serious specific allegations. Things like soliciting and accepting bribes from motorists, deliberately overlooking traffic offenses, even issuing test certificates without actually inspecting the vehicles physically.
Wow. Those aren't minor things, are they? They hit public safety directly on our roads and also trust in an institution like RTSA.
Exactly. And the RTSA Chief Executive Officer, Aman Muwemba, he was quick to condemn these acts. He gave assurances the agency won't condone or protect anyone involved in corruption.
So it suggests maybe an institutional pushback against these practices from within RTSA itself.
Seems like it.
All right, so from enforcement actions, let's look towards ideas for potential reform. Our sources highlight some proposed changes and some interesting dynamics in the political sphere.
Yeah, the 2025 Electoral Reform Technical Committee report, it's put forward some really, really interesting recommendations.
The first one is quite something. It's recommending amending the Constitution to require that the presidential candidate and their running mate must be of different genders.
Wow, okay. And the reason stated.
Pretty straightforward. To actively promote gender equity right at the very top of political leadership.
That's a very direct attempt to engineer more balanced representation, isn't it? It could essentially force parties to look seriously at female candidates for that running mate spot.
And there's another recommendation from that same committee report, this one about appointing ministers.
Okay.
It suggests amending Articles 116 and 117 to allow cabinet ministers to be appointed from outside parliament.
Oh, interesting. That could really broaden the talent pool for ministerial jobs, couldn't it?
Potentially, yeah. It might allow a president to bring in experts, maybe people with specific skills from the private sector or civil society, people who aren't elected MPs directly into the cabinet.
Hmm. That's definitely one to watch.
Now let's touch on some of the political reactions and dynamics that our sources picked up. There are some interesting situations playing out.
Okay, first, the UPND Secretary General, Batuki Menda. He reacted to the stance taken by NGOCC on constitutional amendments. NGOCC, that's the Non-Governmental Organizations Coordinating Council.
Right, a key civil society voice, especially on women's issues.
Exactly. So Mr. Amenda expressed surprise at what he apparently saw as a U-turn from them. He called it purely spin doctoring.
And he referenced a prior appeal by a top NGOCC lady for more women in leadership, suggesting this new stance sort of contradicts that earlier point.
Yeah, we're just relaying what the source stated here, presenting it impartially.
And then there were comments from Paramount Chief Mpizani. They offer a glimpse into some ground level dynamics.
What did he say?
He stated quite directly, apparently, that chiefs in Eastern Province work with the government of the day.
Okay.
And his reasoning, as reported, was because the opposition has no money.
Wow, very direct.
He also raised concerns about what he called crooked contractors doing some works in the province, so pointing to issues with project implementation on the ground.
Hmm. And he also called on politicians generally to, quote, desist from engaging in politics of insults, urging more civility.
Yeah, those comments definitely give us a view from traditional leadership on political realities and maybe development challenges too.
Okay, and there was another situation that sparked some discussion involving a church donation.
Yes, in Mansa. Bishop Patrick Chisanga of the Mansa Diocese apparently rejected a donation. It was K800,000 from President Hichilema and also 200 bags of mealy meal from Peter Kapala intended for a church anniversary.
He rejected it.
Well, according to the source, the bishop's reason was specific: the context and manner of the pledges. He felt it risked compromising the church's long-standing stance of political neutrality and inclusivity.
Right, that highlights the real sensitivity around church and state interactions, doesn't it?
It does. And State House responded through their chief communication specialist, Clayson Hamasaka.
What was their response?
Hamasaka stated that President Hichilema has always been a giver, even long before politics, and he remains committed to acts of giving.
Okay, so again, we're just presenting the different viewpoints reported in the sources on that specific incident.
Exactly. It shows how actions, even ones that seem benevolent, can be viewed very differently depending on the context.
Okay, let's shift gears now, moving from governance and legal structures.
Right, let's focus on Zambia's economic future and, maybe more critically, how we build the workforce to actually power it.
Yeah, and one of the sources today gives this really deep, quite compelling look at something fundamental: the need to truly elevate vocational education, specifically in secondary schools.
Ah, yes, the piece by the International Educator, with experience in Botswana and China.
That's the one.
Yeah.
It brings a really valuable outside perspective.
And their core argument is powerful, isn't it? It cuts right to the heart of things. Basically, Zambia needs to stop treating vocational ed as some kind of second best option.
Right.
And fully embrace it as a legitimate, respected, first choice path within secondary schools.
And this really aligns, as you said, with the spirit of the competence-based curriculum, the CBC, which is already being implemented.
Exactly. The CBC is designed to encourage that practical learning, skills development, which is precisely what vocational education is built on.
But the author identifies a major hurdle.
Yeah.
Currently, vocational learners are still mostly assessed using the academic grade 12 exam framework.
And that framework, they argue, just isn't suited for measuring practical hands-on skills properly.
Precisely. So the proposed solution is, well, quite ingenious, actually.
Hmm.
Create a parallel system.
A parallel system, meaning
a dedicated, respected vocational school certificate. Not some lesser qualification, but one aligned with TVETA, the Technical Education, Vocational and Entrepreneurship Training Authority, and the Zambia Qualifications Framework, the ZQF.
Okay, so it would be official, recognized.
Yes, and crucially, it would be assessed differently. Through practical, competence-based methods like trade tests, portfolios of actual work produced, maybe entrepreneurship projects.
And the author emphasizes why this is so vital, right?
Absolutely. It ensures vocational learners get certified in a way that genuinely reflects their skills. They gain the respect and recognition they deserve.
And it gives them clear pathways forward.
Exactly. Formal pathways to progress, whether that's higher technical training or going directly into meaningful employment, it essentially formalizes and legitimizes the vocational route as a high-value option.
And the article gives some fantastic examples from other countries where this kind of approach is actually working.
It does. Like the Botswana Brigade system. Their vocational training isn't separate. It's embedded right within secondary schools, managed centrally.
So it's integrated.
Yes. And these brigades produce graduates who are genuinely job ready, trained practically in trades like carpentry, agriculture, mechanics, business. The key takeaway the author highlights is that these students aren't marginalized. They're explicitly equipped to work, earn, maybe start their own businesses.
And the China example sounds particularly striking too.
Yeah, the author teaches there and notes that vocational education is actually seen as prestigious. It serves almost half of all secondary students through a highly structured system.
Wow, half.
And crucially, these schools partner directly with industries. There are clear progression routes to technical colleges, even universities. Becoming a skilled technician, a chef, a coder, a builder, these are respected, viable career paths.
So drawing from these models, what are the specific recommendations for Zambia?
Well, they include formally establishing these vocational pathways within secondary schools, certifying learners based on practical skills and performance, not just exams, actively involving communities and industries in curriculum design.
Makes sense.
Launching campaigns to promote vocational careers, shift public perception, encouraging strong school industry partnerships, and making sure vocational schools are just as well equipped and well staffed as academic ones.
What I found particularly insightful was the idea of tailoring the skills training to the specific economic strengths of each province. That just seems so logical.
It really does, doesn't it? The author gives specific examples, like for Eastern Province, focusing on agribusiness, irrigation, food processing. That makes perfect sense.
Or for the Copper Belt in Northwestern provinces.
Skills like mine safety, equipment repair, metal fabrication, maybe even food processing linked to the mining sector.
And Southern and Western, with tourism potential.
Focus on hospitality, guiding, catering, livestock care, leather crafting, maybe traditional skills like reed-based furniture.
Lupula and Northern.
Aquaculture, boat repair, sustainable fishing techniques, Lusaka being the capital.
ICT, logistics, media, graphic design, entrepreneurship, I suppose.
Exactly. And then Muchinga. Forestry, organic farming, sawmilling, agro-processing, Central Province. Dairy production, mechanical repairs, grain storage, solar installation.
The practical benefit of tailoring it like that seems huge. It improves employability directly, training young people for jobs that actually exist locally.
And it encourages them to build lives, contribute to development right there in their home regions. It could potentially slow down that rural-urban migration drift and really build up local economies.
The author also clearly outlines the government's role in making this happen. It needs targeted investment.
Absolutely. Things like investing in more colleges specifically for training vocational teachers, expanding existing technical colleges, maybe introducing vocational wings or departments within existing secondary schools.
And developing that dedicated vocational certificate we talked about.
Right. And ensuring equity for vocational learners. Things like bursaries, help with tools, mentorship programs.
And those partnerships seem key too.
Definitely. Strengthening partnerships between vocational institutions, the private sector, even community cooperatives. That's critical for providing real-world experience and making sure the training is relevant to what industry actually needs.
And finally, launching national campaigns.
Yes, to really celebrate and promote vocational success stories. That's key to shifting the public perception, that idea that vocational jobs are somehow less prestigious.
The author's personal take really ties it all together, doesn't it? That their experience shows vocational ed drives dignity, purpose, economic growth.
Yeah, they state Zambia needs policy courage and targeted investment to give vocational education the structure, funding, and importantly, the social status it deserves.
And emphasizing it's not just for academic failures, but for the practically gifted, the technically minded, the builders of tomorrow.
It's about unlocking potential through a dual pathway system. A really powerful call to action from that source, I thought.
Okay, so that's a fantastic deep dive into developing Zambia's human capital. Let's transition now to a major capital project, something physically building part of Zambia's economic future.
Right. The sources report significant progress on First Quantum Minerals FQM's E3 expansion project at the Kansanshi mine.
This is that massive undertaking, right? Valued at $1.25 billion.
That's the one. And it's now reported to be 92% complete.
92%, wow.
Yeah. And this project is incredibly important for the mining sector and for Zambia's national goals, too. Its main aim is to transform Kansanshi into a larger-scale operation focusing on medium-grade copper.
Okay.
Specifically to boost copper production and significantly extend the mine's life by an impressive 20 years.
20 years, that's huge. And it directly contributes to that national target.
Exactly. Zambia's ambitious goal of hitting 3 million metric tons of copper production annually by 2031. This single project, S3, is expected to contribute 1.6 million tons of copper ore each year once it's fully up and running.
Beyond the production numbers, what about the impacts?
Jobs. Substantial impacts highlighted. It's apparently created over 2,500 jobs just during the construction phase.
Okay.
And they expect another 900 permanent jobs once the project is operational. That's a massive boost for employment in the region.
And the broader economic benefits.
Well, the anticipation is a boost to Zambia's economy through increased tax revenue, significant local procurement buying goods and services locally, and community development initiatives supported by the mine.
There were also some interesting details about energy sourcing, weren't there? And local engagement.
Yes. The project plans to predominantly use renewable energy, like hydropower, and they're apparently looking into wind and solar possibilities, too.
And Kansanshi Mine already sources a lot of its power elsewhere.
That's right, 52% from third parties. This is done through the open access policy, which basically lets large power users buy electricity directly from independent generators. That helps free up ZESCO power for domestic and other uses.
And they're even working with ZESCO on solar.
Engaging ZESCO to help set up solar plants, yes.
And the local spending aspect, that sounded significant.
It really did. The source states FQM is spending $72 million every month on Zambian registered suppliers.
$72 million a month.
Yeah. And just looking at the period 2022 to 2024, they spent a total of $294 million specifically on Zambian citizen-owned companies.
Okay. That shows a clear, substantial effort to keep a large chunk of their spending within the local economy, supporting Zambian businesses.
Definitely. It's a major economic engine, that project.
All right, let's switch gears completely now. We'll head to the world of sports for a couple of updates and then wrap up with one final different news item.
Okay. In football news that definitely caught attention this week.
Yeah.
The Chipolopolo International Friendly Matches. The ones against Tunisia and Sudan, scheduled for Morocco, they've been canceled.
Canceled? Why? What happened?
The reason reported is a player boycott.
A boycott? Over what?
Unpaid allowances, apparently.
Yeah.
Specifically stemming from the team's last trip to Russia, plus some other past dues.
And these friendlies were important preparation, weren't they?
Yeah, pretty crucial prep for the upcoming World Cup qualifiers and CN, the African Nations Championship. So the cancellation has real implications for the team's readiness.
How did FAZ react, the Football Association?
FAZ President Keith Wemba reacted strongly. He read an address and was described in the reports as visibly upset and agitated.
What did he say?
He issued a pretty stern warning to the players, cautioned them against what he called underhand moves to sabotage the country and holding the national team at ransom.
Strong words.
Very. His stance was clear. Playing for Zambia should fundamentally be about patriotism.
And he warned there'd be consequences.
He warned that anyone holding the nation at ransom shall never taste Chipolopolo football again. He even mentioned having credible reports of interference and deliberate sabotage by individuals with vested interests.
Wow.
His message was absolutely unequivocal. No individual is bigger than the badge and indeed the country. And loyalty shouldn't be conditional.
It really highlights those tensions, doesn't it? Between player welfare, financial issues, national duty.
Exactly. And we're just reporting his statements factually as they were made.
Okay. On a different football note, something more positive for the future. The U17 women's team.
Yes, the Copper Princesses. They recently learned their opponents for the FIFA U17 Women's World Cup in Morocco next year, 2025.
Who did they draw?
They're in Group F alongside Japan, New Zealand, and Paraguay.
How did the coach react, Carol Kanyemba?
She described the group as tricky, particularly noting the challenge of facing Japan again. They lost to them 4-1 last year.
Right. But she's still positive.
Yeah, despite that, she sounded upbeat about her team's readiness. They know it's a tough draw, clearly, but seem prepared to face the challenge on the world stage. Good luck to them. Okay, and finally, just one more item from the sources. This one brings us a report from the local legal scene.
Okay, what is it?
It reports on the sentencing of a 38-year-old woman, Irene Nkata, from Kuku Compound in Lusaka.
And the sentence?
She was convicted and sentenced to 1 year civil imprisonment.
What was the charge?
Trafficking in 114.6 grams of cannabis. This stemmed from an incident back on February 27th, 2025.
Did she contest it?
No. According to the report, she admitted the charge. And when the magistrate asked what she was doing with the cannabis, she apparently just stated she was smoking it.
Okay. A brief but clear report on a specific legal outcome there.
Wow. We've definitely covered a lot of ground today, haven't we?
We really have, from, you know, mourning the passing of a former president and seeing these shifts in the legal and political landscape.
To tracking huge investments in mining, grappling with those critical ideas about the future of skills training.
And even the challenges facing our national football team. It's quite a snapshot.
It really is a diverse collection of stories. And when you step back and look at, say, the call for more gender balance in elections, the efforts to tackle corruption, the huge foreign investment creating jobs, and that urgent, compelling argument for fundamentally changing how we view and implement vocational education. How do all these seemingly separate pieces start to fit together, you think?
That's the question, isn't it? They certainly paint a picture of a country navigating change, facing some serious challenges, but also actively looking for pathways to progress.
So what kind of future is being built through all these varied developments? And maybe more importantly for you, the listener, what questions does this snapshot of news raise for you?
Yeah, there's definitely a lot to think about there. How governance, economic strategy, developing our human potential, even national pride reflected in sports.
Oh.
How it all interplays in Zambia's journey right now.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you for joining us for this deep dive into the sources today. We really encourage you to keep exploring these topics, keep thinking about them.
Until next time.